Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power, and boy, are we going to take you on a trip today. Do you like James Bond? Do you enjoy mystery novels? Are you fascinated and intrigued with intrigue? Well, my guest today, Chris Adams, is a gentleman that I know you're going to enjoy because I had the privilege of reviewing two of his books, and they are powerhouses. First one is Requiem of a Spy, and the second one is Dallas. So we're going to be talking about both of them. But first, I want to welcome Chris Adams to the show. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Donna, from way out here in Texas. It's really a pleasure to speak with you again and to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what. When it was suggested by a lady, Beverly, who had been a guest on my show, she wrote the book, The Colonel is a Lady. We had such a wonderful rapport, and I got a call from her about a month or so ago, and she said, Donna, you really need to see this material written by Chris Adams. I said, sure, tell him to send me some books, and you did. I got a beautiful letter from you. I was stunned with what I received and absolutely fascinated with the information that you put out. So I want my audience to know about your background. You're a retired U.S. Air Force Major General and former Chief of Staff of the Strategic Air Command. You're a former Associate Director, Los Alamos National Laboratory, and Industry Executive. You've traveled all around the world. You were in Russia. You're very, very familiar with Russia, which, by the way, is the basis of information for most of your books. And you were there from what I remember you're telling me from 1990 to 1995, and you had 23 extended visits to Russia alone. You have received a number of military honors, the Distinguished Service Medal, the Department of Defense Meritorious Service Medal, two Legions of Merit, two Air Medals for service in combat, and a number of others. You've been awarded the Daughters of the American Revolution National Medal of Honor for 2011. You have been honored as a distinguished alumnus of Tarleton State University and Texas A&M University Commerce. You are a man that has had just this incredible background, and you decided to take your knowledge, your experience, and put it into written form. You have books that are nonfiction, but you decided you wanted to write fiction. Why?
Well, I'll tell you what, Donna, to begin at the end of the beginning, I guess. I never had the inclination to write, much less anything, other than a letter or so. But an event occurred with me in 1998, in the summer of 1998. That's just 15 years ago. That in New Mexico, cooling off from the summer heat in the mountains, and a chance to pick up the Albuquerque Journal one Sunday morning, scanning the front page. And there was an article at the centerfold that I would not pay any attention to, except that I recognized a photograph inset of a former colleague of mine at Los Alamos. And so I began to read the article. It was about an economic development conference just completed at the University of Mexico. And as I read on, I hit an absolute a brick wall with a statement in there that said that whereas Dr. Robinson said there was no Cold War, and even if there were, we didn't win it. What it really amounted to was a conflict between two economic giants in which one outspent the other. Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, the hackles blared on the back of my neck. I sat there for a minute in absolute disbelief that anyone, intellectually or academically notwithstanding, would make such a statement about the 45-year Cold War that we suffered. Thought about it long and hard that afternoon. I walked around kicking rocks and what have you. And finally that evening, I sat down and hand-wrote a note, actually a letter to the editor of the Albuquerque Journal. I didn't have a laptop or anything with me at the time. Don't think I could even use one then. I scribed out a note to him and really poured out my heart, I thought, in the letter to the Journal. And back in the mailbox next morning on Monday and was going to let it go. And then on Thursday of that week, I received a call from one of the editors at the Albuquerque Journal and said, "We received your letter, and boy, you really made a power shot." And I said, "Well, I probably got a little over emotional with it." And so we talked to him for a few minutes, and he said, "Well, I like it. We're going to print it."
Mm-hmm.
So come Sunday, I opened up the paper again, and there was my letter, and I was quite pleased with it. Very frank, I still have a copy of it. Anyway, that was sort of it. I got it off. Well, then on the journey back to Texas, I began to think about, you know, if we have folks out there, intellectually or otherwise, making such statements in order to make a point in some presentation, then, you know, maybe somebody, I'd looked around, I'd read lots of books, I'd spent 5 years in Russia, as you commented, and lots of time in the United States Air Force and strategic operations and on, but I had never seen anything about the Cold War really written or demonstrated that exclusively. So I began to think about it, and I'll make this very short. I sort of scoped out in my mind a 12-chapter outline of a, if you will, Genesis to Exodus story of the Cold War. And so I got it all down in my mind and what have you, and I got back to Texas and scribed it all out, an outline of each of the chapters that I felt I might put in there, sent out some letters, some 24 letters to old mentors of mine, Air Force generals, Navy admirals that I'd worked for, then the Joint Staff and what have you, and along with a whole gang of my colleagues, my crew dogs, if you will, that I served with in the cockpit and what have you. And I was, to my surprise, I received an answer from every one of those letters that I put out there, and really with a lot of urging and a lot of enthusiasm to go for it and write it, and receive so much material and so much, so many references to go here, go there, look at this, and then some. I still have files and files and files of papers and documents that were sent to me to look at and. So I started on this quest of writing. I'm going to put this sucker together and make it good. Well, I want to tell you, and you're a writer yourself, after about 6 or 7 months, I hit an absolute roadblock. Somebody later told me that's called writer's block. I didn't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And I just gave up. I put it aside and said, this is just too much. Well, about a month or 6 weeks after I laid that aside, I'd worked on it for 6 or 7 months, and back in late 98, early 91, 90, I mean, then I received a phone call. My mother used to tell me, she said, you know, the good Lord takes after fools and little children. She never told me which one I was, but I received a phone call from the Air Force's Air University Press out of Montgomery, Alabama, and one of the editors on the phone said, I understand you're writing an epical piece on the Cold War, nonfiction. And I said, well, I've started it, but I've laid it aside. Well, we talked for a bit, and then he asked me to send him some manuscript. I sent him about 250 or so pages. And gosh, within about, I don't know, it seemed like a month or maybe 6 weeks, I get back, sent back to me a complete manuscript, formatted, laid out, book ready for publication, 200-page monograph, if you will. They titled it for me, Inside the Cold War, A Cold Warrior's Reflections, and it was a personal side of book. I really liked it, and so I told them to go for it and publish, which they did. And as a matter of fact, a personal side, they asked me if I had anyone that I would like to endorse it. So my first thought came to a young fellow that had been my exec officer back in SAC, Strategic Air Command, Gene Habiger. I let him go as a lieutenant colonel, and Gene went off into the sky and eventually was promoted all the way to 4 stars. the four-star general, and Gene wrote the foreword for me. So it was out there, a 200-page piece, and that inspired me then to, hey, boy, this is good. But I didn't go any farther. Then out of the blue, I received an invitation to review that monograph at the Strategic Air Command reunion in July of 2000. SAC 2000 was called. It was the first reunion of all the SAC folks since the command stood down after the Cold War was over in 1991-92. Well, I reviewed the book, some 1,500 folks in the audience. There were 5 four-star generals on the front row, all retired, including the late David Jones, my mentor, General Russ Doherty, and on and on, just an overwhelming group. But during the course of me giving that, I made sort of a smart remark like it was too much, I was going to do something else, but I've decided not to write the main book that I had set out to do. Well, during break time after that presentation, General Doherty came up to me and said, Chris, what in the world are you telling me you're not going to do what you set out to do? And a lot of us got together and encouraged you, gave you information, what have you. I said, yes, sir. So anyway, bottom line, he said, you get your fanny back to Texas and you finish what you set out to do. So
don't you just love it when somebody does that? You're sitting there, you think you've got everything all set up, and the jig whiz, you're not going to bother with this. And then somebody looks at you and says, what do you mean? We put all this effort in. We gave you this information. We're not going to do it. You're going to do it. This, I think, is absolutely awesome with another general, you know, telling you this. I mean, this is fabulous.
Well, so I came back, and then there was another intervention in my life during that time that I began to work on the book that I finally published entitled Ideologies in Conflict. It's a 628-page piece of work, make a great doorstop or armpit mattress, I guess, or pillow. At any rate, during this time I was working on that, I happened to be back in Washington and working on some pro bono with an old think tank intelligence friend of mine, Dr. Ray Klein, who we lost here a couple of years ago, a former director, the deputy director of the CIA. And Ray asked me one day, he said, hey, what are you doing for dinner this evening? And I said, well, I don't have any plans. He said, good, let's go to dinner. I want you to meet a friend of mine. Have you ever met Tom Clancy? And I said, no, I've never met Clancy. So went to dinner, Ray, myself, and Clancy. Sat there for about 3 hours, and Ray told him, you know, that I was thinking about doing some writing and what have you. Well, I received some great advice from Tom Clancy that evening, and that was, hey, take that nonfiction stuff. It's too complicated. It requires too much fact-checking, too much vetting, and put it into a novel. Build yourself some characters and what have you. So that's really, Donna, that's how it all got started, and evolved from that, and I wrote my first novel, Red Eagle, and sort of got the ball rolling, and I've had a lot of fun with it.
The book Requiem of a Spy, I have to say, when I started reading it, it was as if I was experiencing deja vu to a degree, not anywhere close to the experience and information that you related, but the reason that it was sort of a deja vu experience for me is because my husband and I were in Russia in 1992. We were on a very special trip involving the People to People program. It was one of its kind. And I know I shared this with you, but I'll share it with my audience. And we were able to see, as a business group, an underside of Russia that, to the best of my knowledge, there had not been, and I was told this by the person that was the director of this wonderful trip, you're seeing things that nobody else ever sees. And when I started going through your book, and I was reading about Sasha, who is the primary character here, the information that we were given by the Russian people when we were in the former Soviet Union, Kiev, Minsk, St. Petersburg, you know, at Moscow, when we were in these different areas of this phenomenal place, we got so much information and I did interviews over there. And I'm reading your stuff, and I'm going, I can see, I know about this, I know about this, I know about this. But what is so powerful about your book is that you lived experiences. And like Tom Clancy said, when you can take facts, costume them with characterizations, that allows people to understand the intricacies, the complexities many times, of what goes on. And I think at this time with our nation, we are going through so many questioning factors. So many people are saying we don't have enough information. People in positions of power are making decisions. They don't have enough information. They're making choices. Every day we watch stuff on the news. And I ask the question myself, how do you get the right information? And that's one of the gifts that you give in the book Requiem of a Spy. Now, we're going to talk about both of your books, but I want to go into Requiem of a Spy.
Sure.
You have a perspective right at the beginning of your book that you said, in the first sentence, the FBI arrests 12 Russian spies. This was a newspaper headline. They were caught being involved in undercover work within the United States, and the year was 2010. Am I correct?
That is absolutely correct. Well, the undocumented Russians arrested.
Right. So they're shipped out. Now, the average American is absolutely a hardworking, solid citizen. They are not, they're there to provide for their family. They're going to be very responsible people. And they just don't have a clue about the dark side of espionage and the dark side of all of these factors that have been going on for a long time. And you state in your book, the most powerful and aggressive intelligence and secret police organizations in the world have for centuries belonged to Russia. And during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, and this especially under Stalin. I mean, the Bolsheviks, you bring all of this information out in your book. I'm telling you, it's gripping.
Well, you're very kind, and a sidelight to that, which you just touched on, is the fact that the now president of Russia, Mr. Vladimir Putin, has been elected and reelected three times. He was a former KGB lieutenant colonel when the Cold War was over in 1991 and was bright enough to seek politics and has done quite well at it. But he was an in-depth KGB operative officer, as many of those I met in latter day. And as you said very correctly, they're willing to talk. I gained all of my information by conversation. I wasn't there as a spy. I was there as a professional working for a company, trying to help them restore their communication system during those 5 years I was in and out. In fact, I was there in 1992 when you and your husband were there in Minsk and Kyiv and Moscow and so on. But they were really willing to talk. And I drew names, Donna, in my books. I made combinations of names. I do not use any Russian names in my book that are consistent. In other words, I'll take the first name of someone, the last name of someone else. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be pinned down. But Sasha is my hero. Sasha is my best friend, and he has seen me through five books now, and we've become good friends. But the real Sasha is really there, was really there then, and I left him there, but he gave me lots of information on which I traded and would never compromise or anything like that. But everything you said about the underside was there then, and I can comment further when we get to the Dallas book a little bit more about that goes on yet today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that one of the gifts that your book gives is an awareness that we have to understand that as magnanimous as we may want to be, we must be alert and aware to the fact that there are always going to be those individuals that will want to take from those that have and say, oh, we're going to have dominion over you. And as a nation, we've had to fight this from the very beginning. And this is what has made America so unique. This is what has made America the place where people want to come to. But what you talk about in your book, Requiem of a Spy, I think would make one heck of a good movie. But Sasha is someone, and you go through all of these protocols of training. He is picked up. It reminded me of the movie The Manchurian Candidate to a degree. Because in the movie Manchurian Candidate, Angela Lansbury, she's one of my favorite actresses, where she plays the evil woman. She did such a good job of this. But it was the manipulation of the mind, the emotions, the physical environment, the spiritual environment, literally stripping that away, the conscience of a person, so that this was done in a way and manner that your world, if you were in that environment, if you had been raised in that environment, and this can happen anywhere, you were raised in that environment, but that's all you knew. It was very narrow. It was compact. It was very thorough. And there was this attitude, and I saw this firsthand when I did interviews in Russia. There was a woman that my husband was talking with. She was one of our guides. This was in St. Petersburg. And he was telling her that he had had a business, and he had done this and done that and done the other. And she looked at him. She said, that's not possible. You're not telling me the truth. He said, what do you mean? She said, you're a wealthy American. He said, well, not really. We're not multimillionaires. He said, I'm not, but I did this, and this didn't work, so I tried something else. I did something else. She said, no, that doesn't happen. We've been told that Americans, you cannot do that. We can't do it in Russia. You cannot do that. And it really surprised him, and he tried to explain it to her, but her mind was closed. Her mind was closed. And I can remember overhearing a conversation when I was in the National Academy of Sciences in Moscow doing these interviews. I overheard her talking to someone. And it was like I was listening to rhetoric I had heard on newsreels on television. She was established in this mentality, and I saw it, and I thought, it's amazing. These people can travel around the world. They still have that mentality. And you go through that in Requiem of a Spy. You talk about how people are indoctrinated, how they are programmed from a very young age.
Well, the key word, I think, Donna, that overrides exactly what you said is paranoia.
They're paranoia.
It's a paranoid society, and it has been forever and ever and ever. And I tried to characterize that in my book, Ideologies, the nonfiction piece, several years ago, and on into the novel, that they suffer from great paranoia because they're always looking over their shoulder. I never saw so much of that in my life when I was there, and there are all sorts of side stories about that, real life stories that... But it's a very structured society. If you look back in their history, and you have, Russia has never won, quote-unquote, never won a war. Even little old Japanese beat them to death back in the Russo-Japanese War years ago. World War One, they were soundly defeated, and World War Two would have been, too, had we not been there. Mm-hmm. They're so fixed within themselves, culturally and structurally and what have you. But I found lots of friends over there, believe it or not. The Ukrainians, I still have good friends in Ukraine that just absolutely, of course, they don't like the Muscovites either. They hate them. But it's a society that needs watching. It needs watching yet today because they have not given up. They have not given up.
Yes, and I was listening to some things about group of Russians coming over to convene with Putin and coming here to this country, and you give out so much detail about the KGB, but you also talk about another group. There's actually two other groups that you bring out in your book? What are those two other groups, secret agencies?
Okay. Yes, the GRU, which I guess I could best characterize as being more like our, it's the intelligence gathering NSA, National Security Agency type organization comparison, whereas the KGB is of the CIA ilk, and then you have the MVD, which is more like our FBI, if I could take those. And those are broad, very broad comparisons. So if the experts that are listening to this will may challenge that, but that's the best comparison I could make. GRU, more like NSA, highly technical, get deeply involved in research, intellectual research, what have you, where the KGB are strictly their spies, their undercover spies, they project them. And in the book, in Requiem, and the others preceding that, I worked Sasha out of the GRU because I wanted him to be a more of a softer, kinder individual than, and trained there as opposed to the KGB, although he did go through KGB schooling, as you know, in reading the story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then became an agent and, put in our country undercover and on and on and on.
And it's associated with the B-52, a disappearance of the B-52. Now, I know
yeah.
we're going to be going on break, and for those of you listening, we're going to be coming back with Chris Adams. Requiem of a Spy is absolutely a phenomenal read. It gives you information. It gives you detail. It allows you to understand aspects of culture that many of us, really, until you experience it, you don't believe that it's possible, especially if you're an American. There are so many things in this book that are really eye-openers relative to the world of the spy, also to the economic positions of nations, why things are done to a degree, and how the game, you always need to be aware of how the game is played, and patience, planning, perseverance, all of these things come into the story, but it has a dynamic association with the B-52. And even if you're not familiar with any of this, you'll say, whoa, if you are someone that loves, again, anything like James Bond, mysteries, undercover, espionage, anything of this nature, you're going to find this is a phenomenal read. Now, we're coming back with Chris Adams. We're taking a short break. Requiem of a Spy is what we've been talking about. But now we're going to go to Dallas. Dallas, November 22nd, 1963. Was the assassin all by himself? Or was he a pawn? We're going to find out more about that. So don't go away. We've got some real good information to share with you. Donna Siebel here. We'll be right back.
As a counselor, Donna Siebel is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Donna Siebel, welcome back. We are with Chris Adams, his book, Dallas, November 22, 1963. was the assassin of President Kennedy? Well, did he work all by himself? Or was he used to cover up something much deeper and more involved? Today, we've got so much controversy going on about this even now. Records have been sealed away for 50 years. And Chris Adams, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Donna. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Now, Chris, I know you live in Texas. This situation happened in Dallas. With the way that you think and with your writing, you've done so many books, both fiction and nonfiction. This was right in your own neighborhood, so to speak. You garnered so much detail and information about the assassination of President Kennedy, putting it in this book, Dallas. What prompted you to decide you were going to take this on? Now, Sasha, the character that you had in Requiem of a Spy, you bring Sasha into this. Now, in Requiem of a Spy, Sasha ends up going back to Russia. That's where he ends up going back to his home. However, Sasha ends up in this becoming an investigator into the assassination of President Kennedy. Why?
Well, I'll tell you what, Donna, actually, 10 years ago, I did a 40th anniversary on the assassination. I entitled it Profiles in Betrayal, a novel as well. And I felt like coming up on the 50th, I wanted to do it again. And again, it's a novel, it's a narrative, it's a parody. But there's a lot of facts in there. As you commented earlier, I really feel like I write factions. It's a lot of fiction based on facts. I became very intrigued when I was in Russia and out of Russia, back here and reading. I have a copy of the Warren Report. I have lots of background material and data. But the great mystery lies in the fact that here's a ne'er-do-well Marine, served almost his 4 years before he was kicked out of the Marine Corps. I'm talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. Was in jail three times, court-martialed three times while he was on active duty. Finally kicked out of the Marine Corps. And 2 weeks after he departed, he had a passport and was on his way to find his way to Russia. Caught a ship and went over to Loire, France, on into Southampton, and on into Helsinki. In a matter of days, found himself there. Had no money. Allegedly, his mother loaned him a little bit. He ends up in Helsinki, checks into the Torni Hotel. And I've been to the Torni Hotel, by the way, on one of my trips over there. I made a point of going to the Torni just to see it. Much different now than it was then, obviously. He applies for a visa when he arrives on Friday in Helsinki, a six-day visa to go to Russia. In those days, it would take nominally 2 weeks or so to get a visa, even a short visit visa to go in and visit. That was on Friday. Monday morning, he gets a call from the Russian embassy in Helsinki that he has a visa. He catches a ferry, goes across to Petersburg, and catches the Red Air Express, and zoom, he's down in Moscow. He's met there by a dead tourist, and I have the name in the book, Elena. Most unusual for an American tourist to be met by an tourist. And tourists, by the way, go back into the background, they really are a subject of the KGB. They operated under the KGB rules and what have you, although they were supposed to be gracious greeters and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that was a big eye-opener for me. That's what we were associated with when we traveled, and I went, oh, my goodness, KGB, here we
That's
go.
Right. That's right. They were part of the system. Well, he was in Moscow for 5 days. He was told he had to leave. This is Oswald again. Allegedly, he tried to commit suicide. He cut his wrist and was put in the hospital. And voila, after a day in the hospital, the guy's up and out and sent by the Soviet government to Minsk. When he arrives in Minsk, which is really another mystery, met by the mayor of Minsk. I was there many times. You were, too. I don't think the mayor met you and greeted you, Mr. Pavlov.
No, that's absolutely true. We didn't have that kind of greeting.
You didn't get greeted, neither did I, but Mr. Oswald was given a job, a very good job with Gorazant Satellite Factory at the time. I did some work with Gorazant when I was there, later in later years, obviously. A very good job, given an apartment, more upscale than that. So anyway, the intrigue goes on, the mystery goes on about all this attention given to a ne'er-do-well, throwaway 20-year-old at the time, 21-year-old, I guess, by then, ex-Marine, thrown out of the Marine Corps. Suddenly he's been treated like a king over there. He stays a little over 3.5 years. He meets Marina, marries her. She happens to be the niece of the MVD, the Belarus MVD chief. It's the civilian police that I commented earlier. And then brings her back. They have a baby while they're there, and then brings her back to the United States. Most unusual, and I just heard a comment last night on one of the news, lots of news in Texas now about the assassination. The unusual aspect that Marina was allowed to come back to the United States. And she met up with some Russian folks in Dallas, and the story goes on and on. But the bottom line of Dallas, again and again, it's a novel. I want everybody to understand that. The paranoia part of it. The Cuban crisis, as you recall, occurred just 1 year prior to that. I happened to be there. That's part of Sasha. Sasha and I flew the Cuban crisis in B-52s, and actually so. And the Russians were greatly, Khrushchev, greatly embarrassed by President Kennedy. It put him down. Stopped. The Cuban crisis was over as a result of Kennedy's reaction to the Cuban crisis. Put the B-52s in there. We circled around the Soviet Union and brought them to their knees, and they withdrew from Cuba. Greatly embarrassed by the Chinese, but also greatly embarrassed by his own people, the KGB in particular, and the Soviet premiers at that time, probably still today, serve at the pleasure of the KGB. If they don't have their support, they're not there in charge, a la Mr. Putin today.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't want to be paranoid about this, but so many mysteries surrounded this thing, and then, of course, Oswald's back here. He acquires, you know, guns and weapons, and is the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. And I don't want to go overboard with this. Again, it's a novel. I want to keep it in that perspective.
I guess you can keep it in that perspective. But there's a lot of people that, in reading your novel, would say this makes sense. Why were we not, as American citizens, notified or made aware of certain things? And from what I understand, even though the files regarding the assassination should be opened and made available to the public, I wonder how much is going to be inked out, where we're not going to be able to find out really what happened. And it has been demonstrated through so many programs that the typical assumption of where he was, Oswald was, and his, that he didn't shoot. He wasn't the one. It's like he was a cover-up for something else because of some other bullet that was fired from another positioning. And you mentioned that, and I'm not going to give it away. You mentioned that a particular positioning of an individual in the very close area to the president, how they could have actually fired and killed President Kennedy. So you bring in so many different aspects, but what I really, really like is that there is so much meat, and I'll use that term, maybe it's a crude term, but there's so much meat of information, and it causes a person to think. It makes us aware that sometimes where we expect people to have integrity and honesty with us, because that's what we want from those people that seemingly represent us, which in many cases they don't, they are so detached from the real reality of what's going on. We have so many different levels in society, and to stand guard and to be alert and not to be paranoid is really a pretty big challenge, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is, and we Americans, and I'm one, you're one, and we love this great country, but we're so quick to grab the first bit of information, the quote-unquote evidence, and say, that's it. But if you delve into, even Robert Kennedy himself doubted greatly the Warren Commission report. It was done quickly, over with, lots of pages, but the bottom line was that something happened. The autopsy reports, what have you, you can bring all that gross material up. And so many questions arise from that, and I would not dare go to a nonfiction approach to this or try to write a factual. That's why I guess I take the easy way out by going to a novel and raising mm-hmm. as many questions as I can. And certainly, I'm not paranoid about this. I don't want to be, but try to keep it as horrible as it was, as sad an event it was, to keep it in perspective, and I guess keep it light is what I'm trying to say.
You give a vision and a real picture with truth to it. I know, because I saw segments of this myself, as did my husband. This to the Russian environment, to a societal environment, and it causes you to have a great deal of compassion for a people who have been terrorized, as you mentioned, as we first started talking. Their history is replete with terrorism just among
yes.
their own ranks. And then those from those on the outside. In the Second World War, actually, with the Japanese, if it hadn't been for the Americans, the Russians would have starved to death. We had shiploads of food that was sent over to them. We had military that was sent over to them. We provided them so much. I find it ironic that the eagle and the bear are always at odds, and yet their hand is always extended out saying, give me more. I want more. And then also we've got the dragon, and that's China. So you've got the three powers, the eagle, the dragon, and the bear. They're a fascinating...
Write a good book about that. Well, now it is indeed. And I might comment, Donna, if I might, at the back end of it. I just took a flyer on this. I talked to my co-writer, Mayor Ward, about inserting this. But I put a codicil or a summary at the back of Dallas. I'm sure you read it. And it's not fiction. It's the real thing. And I just sort of highlighted the events from 1991 forward to today with regard to Mr. Putin being in office. Those 20 years acquired a $43 billion personal wealth as president three times of Russia, the undocumented 12 in 2010 that you mentioned. On April the 18th, at the very time that President Obama sat down with President Putin at the 8th conference in Mexico City, 30 Russian bombers flew right up the Aleutian chain and sort of stuck their noses out and their thumbs, I guess, at the Americans and flew back. At that very moment, that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
6 months later, after that, in October of last year, 2012, you announced withdrawal of the Nuclear and Chemical Weapons Reduction Pact. That's the Nunn-Lugar Act that we spent about $500 million in trying to help them managing and control nuclear weapons. And, you know, and the story goes on. The American-Russian adoption program abruptly canceled just last December, leaving a lot of folks that spent a lot of money going over and bonding with young orphans to be told they can't come back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it goes on. And then just this year, February the 16th, on the night of President Obama's State of the Union address, two IL-92 bombers fly over the territory of Guam. That's our sovereign island out there. Flew over, circled around, and went back. So I guess we'd say we still are engaged in a global standoff, if you will. And I like to comment, the elephant is still in the room. He just gained a little bit more weight as we watch it go by.
That's all right, but the elephant, he's maybe sitting down and saying, okay, I'll get so big that you're not going to be able to ignore me.
Yeah, rubbing together while we find ourselves, you know, embroiled in the Middle East and other things. He's sitting back and having some pleasure. But anyway,
Well, Chris, this has been wonderful. And both of your works, for those of you listening, Dallas and Requiem of a Spy, I encourage you to go to literaryworks.com. And Works is spelled W-E-R-K-S. And they'll find out more information about your books there, won't they?
Yes, they sure will. And, of course, if someone wants to purchase a book, we're always delighted. Amazon, of course, carries them amongst others. Author House, is the publisher of Requiem and so on. So a lot of fun doing it. And, Don, I can't thank you enough. This has really been a special pleasure, particularly your background in traveling in Russia. And at the same time, I was there, and those were really eye-opening days during that period of time. I guess they are today as well. But then, right after the Cold War, it was really an incredible experience.
Yes, it was. Chris Adams, Major General, retired of the United States Air Force. Check out his material. I'll tell you, it just is a grip you will not want to relinquish until you get through all of the fabulous story that he has put together. Nothing else. It'll create a thinking process that maybe you've wanted to explore but didn't quite know how to put the pieces together. Dallas, Lone Assassin or Pawn, about the murder of President Kennedy, and this is the 50th anniversary. Records are to be released this year. And then also Requiem of a Spy. I tell you, good material. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. I am just so thrilled to have had Chris Adams on the show, and I want to share a personal story with you. When I was in Russia in 1992, and I was doing interviews at the National Academy of Sciences in Moscow, I had a gentleman with me, and I was doing interviews, and at that time, the telephone lines weren't working. I couldn't communicate with my studio, so what I did, I put the interviews on an audio tape, and then it was taken to a DHL office, and I had to get permission from the Russian government to be able to send them outside of the United States. And all of the interviews that I did were sent via audio tape and broadcast here in Washington at the station that I was working at that time. After I did the interview with this one gentleman who was one of the top attorneys within the Communist Party, he said to me something that I've never forgotten, and I doubt I ever will. He said, "You Americans have this fire inside of you. You Americans have this belief. You're born with it, that you have a right to be free." And I'm sitting there in front of him, and I looked at him, and I said, "Yes, we do." He said, "We Russians don't." And he then told me a personal story. It was about his grandparents. During the time of Stalin, his grandparents were able to relieve Russia. They were able to get out. The Stalin purges were terrifying, just horrific. They were able to escape. They were able to come to America. They located in a city, a big city. I don't know if it was Detroit, Chicago, I don't remember, Cleveland, I don't know, but it was a big city. he had the opportunity to be able to leave Russia, because he was in the upper circle, to come to visit the United States. Again, he was one of the top attorneys. He came over. He knew where his grandparents were, and he went to visit them. His grandparents, every single day, would always look over their shoulders, no matter where they went. He said, my grandparents were terrified that they were going to be forced to come back to Russia. Until they died, he said, they were terrified that they were going to be sent back to Russia. This is how deep the fear went. Now, obviously, he went back to Russia. They did not. They died here in America. But what Chris said during the interview, the fear, the depth of fear, and when you study the history of the people, the psyche, the soul, the essence of a people, that is that they've experienced such horrific things throughout their history, just within their own culture, not only from outside being invaded, but also from within. And this is something that I think had such an impact on me. And I remember when I came back to the United States, everyone that had been on that trip, by the way, felt the way I did. You wanted to get down on the ground and kiss it. Because freedom is so precious. And when I got back into the United States, having seen such privation in a nation, and knowing and interviewing so many people, whether their position was that in medicine or anything else, knowing what they had gone through, the honest conversations we had, I realized one of the greatest things that freedom gives is the opportunity of choice, the opportunity to fail, the opportunity to explore, the opportunity to grow, to expand, to be able to be the best you can be, and even do it in the way you want to do it. It is a phenomenal thing, and until you've seen the other side or multiple aspects of another environment that doesn't bring this in, it's very hard to comprehend because we take it for granted. Remember, I know we're running out of time here. You're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I end the show every day with that statement because it is important. What goes on in the little gray cells of the brain, as Hercule Poirot so often is stating in his programming, when you do that, you must realize that you must educate yourself. You don't shut the door to learning, period. You realize you're never, ever too young, too old to learn something new. You realize it's important for you to nourish your life with information to the best of your capacity. But you also have to check it out, because not everything is going to be shining and sparkling. I'm so grateful to you. I'm so grateful for you sharing this time with me, because I know your schedules are busy ones. Hey, tomorrow we're going to be talking with Ghosts on the Red Line. That's right, with Peter Shapiro. This is mesmerizing, too. Novels often contain facts, because that's how, just like Tom Clancy taught Major General Chris Adams, take the truth and put it in fiction, and you'll be heard. That wisdom goes on and on and on. Thank you for being with me today. Won't you join me tomorrow? Great people, good people. There's a lot of them in this world. You're one of them. Thank you. This is Donna Sebo. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.